and welcome again to the Ask Beatty Show. And I can hardly believe that this is the last Monday in 2019. And I was looking at the archives, and today is the 283rd Ask Beatty Show that I've done here on the Progressive Radio Network. And there's been about 172,000 of you who have downloaded the various shows. And of course, since I never really have an opportunity to meet the majority of you live, I oftentimes wonder what the impact has been. Because the real reason why I love doing the Ask Beatty Show is that I hope after every single show and during every single show that there is some little thing that I say that will help motivate and inspire you to do what is in your best interest when it comes to your own individual issues and your couple issues. And I'm really hoping that there has been some real positive impact for those of you who've been a listener for all of these years. Because the reality is, and of course you hear me saying this every single week, is that whether or not we are rich or poor or black or white or straight or gay or bi or fluid or transgender, we all go through so many ups and downs in our life. And of course, the real question is, you know, the lessons to be learned, and even more importantly, the plan of action. And even more important than the plan of action is the action itself. I mean, if you look at the depression statistics as an example in this country, there are 16 million adults in the United States who are suffering from clinical depression. That translates into 1 in 5 Americans. 40 million adults suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders. The divorce rate in this country, you know, despite the fact that we have all of these relationship books, the divorce rate continues to really soar. For first marriages, it is 48%. For second marriages, and so many people are just really, really surprised to hear this, it's 67%. For third marriages, 74%. Three women are killed every single day by their so-called intimate partner. So again, what have we learned and what are we learning if we've had issues in our relationships? And of course, you've heard me talk for the last several years about the things that we need to do so that we are never going to make a mistake in love again. And again, as a reminder, you know, we can wish and we can hope that we're going to have this happily ever after love affair. But first of all, if each of us is not in a really good place emotionally and psychiatrically and psychologically, we're really not in a position to be able to make really good decisions. Because, you know, so many people hope that the prince or the princess is going to rescue us and make everything okay. But as I've said to my daughter Jordana over the years, is that the relationship really needs to be the icing on the cake. And we need to be the cake, and we need to be the foundation. And if the depression or the anxiety or the substance abuse or other issues are really getting in the way of your life and of your relationship, the real question is, what are you planning to do about it? And so many people will say, well, someday I may get some help, or someday if I have a variety of different physical issues, someday I might move, someday I may decide to exercise. Well, I'm hoping that someday is actually today, so that you can begin for the new year, for 2020, to do some things differently that are really going to be in your self-interest. And I think that that's something that we have to think about. We really do need to be mindful as we go throughout our days. Are the things that we are doing, are they really good for us? And after every single session, when I see patients in my private practice here in New York City and in East Hampton, that's the question. That's the homework that I really like to leave everybody with, so that we are careful, that we are mindful. As an example, you know, if we're looking at diet, and Dr. Gary Null, he talks about this every single day, the importance of plant-based diets, the fruits, the vegetables, the grain, the fish, the nuts, versus going to McDonald's and having a cheeseburger, you know, or having McNuggets. Are we mindful? Because we have the knowledge, and we do have the research behind the knowledge. So again, when you're going and you're thinking about, what am I going to be eating today? Is it something that is really going to be nutritious? Or is it something that is going to have negative physical / emotional consequences to you and to your body? So it's about thinking as we go along about the things that we do, the people that we interact with. Is all of this good for us? Is all of this, or all of the things that we are doing, really in our best interest? The exercise, we know that exercise is really important. The weight training, the meditation, the yoga, having supportive people in our life. And I ask people all the time, and I ask you every single week here on the Ask Beatty Show. And of course, I ask my patients every single week when I see people, taking a look at the people in our lives. Are they supportive? Are they respectful? Are they loving? Or on the other hand, are these people who are really toxic? Toxic people who are critical, toxic people who don't hear you, toxic people who are not empathic, toxic people who really may want the worst for you. So, and it's about really being honest. And I think that we do need to do an inventory, not just, you know, just once a year. You know, it's really interesting. I had a patient yesterday, and let's call her Carol. Carol is a 64-year-old woman who grew up in a very, very abusive family environment, although she was really not aware until she became a lot older that the beatings and the sexual abuse and the verbal and emotional abuse was something that did not happen in most families. And she had undergone a tremendous amount of therapy, had actually had shock treatment, had had a couple of different hospitalizations. And she was referred to me last year. And, you know, she was saying to me yesterday, she said every single time that she would come to my private practice here in New York City, she would leave in tears because she realized that she was finally going to have to deal with a lot of unfinished business and what I call skeletons in the closet that were really continuing to get in the way of her life. And I asked her yesterday, I said, Carol, I said, if there was one thing that you have really learned, because she is doing great right now. The depression is really gone. She's exercising. I had convinced her to ask her boss for a tremendous raise, a very, very well-deserved raise, which she actually got. And she said, you know, the one thing that really made a difference was eliminating toxic people from her life, including family members. And she says, you know, I never thought about it before. She says, I thought that I really just kind of needed to say yes when I meant no and allow people to do and to say whatever it is they wanted to do or say to me. And for her, that was the number one thing that has really made a difference, that cleared the way for her to be able to go about her life in a really healthy way. And of course, she has one more task that she needs to do. And that is, she needs to extricate herself from her married boyfriend, who has virtually nothing to give her at all. And, you know, we were laughing about it yesterday. All the toxicity is really gone. This is a man who in himself is really not toxic, although she has to really come to the realization that somebody who is married is completely unavailable to her, only on his own terms. And as she left, she said, you know, she says, I've tackled so many other issues with you, Beattie, and this is something that I am planning to do, of course, at my own pace in 2020. I've been trying to convince her to get a new headshot, to get a new profile, and to finally put herself on one of the many dating sites. And of course, she can go to church, she can go to synagogue, she can interact in a variety of different ways and find herself an emotionally available man. And she's finally realizing, and she was saying this to me, you know, I deserve better. And so she does. You know, other things that we need to, of course, remind ourselves about, you know, if we really start to get down on ourselves, is positive visualization and dancing and listening to music. You know, I find if I'm feeling down or I'm feeling anxious, I'll ask my husband, Jim, to put on some Broadway tunes. Broadway tunes for me is really the greatest antidote for things that might ail me if I'm feeling uptight, if I'm feeling anxious, if I'm feeling a little bit down. And yes, it's true. Therapists also do feel down and anxious and depressed. And of course, we all, like everybody else, we all have our own issues that hopefully we are going to be tackling. In fact, I have a guest that's going to be coming up in a few minutes, Lori Gottlieb, and she will be talking about much more what she has learned as a psychotherapist and an author about herself, about her patience, and about life in general. And, you know, other things that we can do that really are helpful to us is helping other people. And it's amazing what happens, you know, when you're able to really give of yourself. No agenda in mind, just unconditional love and unconditional giving, just because, for no particular reason. Journaling is also a good thing. And I've been reading more and more articles about the benefits, physically, of course, and emotionally and psychologically, of having a dog. Great company, great way to meet people and socialize. I mean, we live on the Upper West Side in New York City. And I would say that because of Cha-Cha, our dog, I mean, I have met dozens and dozens and dozens of people and have had dozens and dozens and dozens of interactions that I never, ever would have had if it were not for the fact that we needed to walk Cha-Cha several times a day. So again, there are many, many things that we can do that are really in our best interest. And of course, we need to be honest with ourselves, and we need to assess whether or not the life, the career, the friends, the family are all things that are nurturing to us. And of course, that does not mean that we're not going to have any issues. It does not mean that you're going to exit all relationships because there are problems. But what we want to see, whether it's in our romantic relationships or friend relationships or collegial relationships, is that if the relationships are going to work, and if the relationships are really, really going to be healthy, we need to surround ourselves with people who are willing to acknowledge and address and resolve problems and are not going to blow us off. You know, which reminds me of another patient who I am treating, who has really been through the mill, in and out of homeless shelter. She's now in a much better place financially, in and out of psychiatric hospital. She's bipolar. And one of her wishes last year was to find someone, and she had been married and divorced many, many, many years ago. And the relationship, for the most part, seems to be going very, very well. However, she was telling me that when issues arrive, as they do in all relationships, it doesn't matter how great your relationship is, there's always going to be something that her now boyfriend simply blows her off. He'll say, oh, well, goodbye, or oh, well, I love you. And that was yesterday. And what she's finding is that more and more and more, there is more unfinished business, and she's becoming more and more and more agitated. And we were talking about this, the pros and the cons. Yes, she loves him. They have a lot of fun together, but he is completely unwilling to deal with issues. So what to do? So what today, in fact, is her birthday. I have to send her a happy birthday text or email. And she said, look, Beattie, she said, you know what? She says, I am really getting more and more and more fed up, but I am not willing to celebrate my birthday, and I'm not willing to celebrate New Year's alone. So the plan is, the homework that she agreed to was that next week, after her New Year's Eve celebration, that she is going to sit down and she is going to tell him that she loves him and she cares for him, but that this is not working for her. And we're going to have to see really what happens. And it's hard. It's really hard for people to confront other people, because you never quite know what the other person's response is going to be. I mean, I have another patient who has been involved with a man for the past year, and he too, it's got to be his way. It's his way or the highway. And she cares about him, and she wants the relationship, and they do have fun together, and they dance, and they listen to music, and they go to games. And it is, it's a nice experience. But again, issues will arise, and he refuses to talk about it, you know. And in a nutshell, she needs to make a decision whether or not the pros really outweigh the minuses. When there are put-downs, when he yells at her, when he tells her that somehow she is not adequate enough, does that make up for the fun and the dances and the sex? I don't think so. I really don't think so. So again, she's going to have to make a decision whether or not she is going to deal, or whether or not she is going to allow and enable the relationship toxicity to really continue. Well, I am so excited to have Lori Gottlieb as my guest today. Lori is a psychotherapist and New York Times bestselling author who writes the weekly Dear Therapist advice column for The Atlantic, where she is also contributing editor. She's written for the New York Times Magazine and has appeared on the Today Show and Good Morning America and CBS, CNN, NPR, and she lives in Los Angeles. And Lori, I am so thrilled that you are here, and I love, love, love your book.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it was because my daughter, Jordana, she actually emailed me. She said, Mom, she said, you have to read Lori Gottlieb's book. Maybe you should talk to someone, a therapist, her therapist, and other lies reveal. So listen, Lori, what made you decide? What inspired you to write the book?
Well, actually, I was supposed to be writing a book about happiness.
Uh-huh. Okay.
the happiness book was making me miserable. The irony was not lost on me. And it was because I was looking at what was going on in the therapy room, and I really felt like there was so much richness and humanity that people don't get to see that I found really inspiring. And I also feel like a lot of what we see nowadays is this quest for quote-unquote happiness, but happiness is really beside the point. And I don't mean that we don't want to be happy.
Right.
I just mean that Happiness as a byproduct of living our lives in a fulfilling way is great, but happiness as the end goal is often a recipe for disaster. And so what I did, and maybe you should talk to someone, is I follow the lives of four patients, and I brought people into my therapy room. And then there's a fifth patient in the book, and that fifth patient is me, as
right.
I'm going through my own therapy. And I did that because, you know, I didn't want to be the clinician up on high. I wanted to show that, you know, as I say at the beginning of the book, that my greatest credential is that I'm a card-carrying member of the human race.
Absolutely. And you did it. And you did that so well, by the way.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I mean, I it was really important to me that, you know, we see how we're all more the same than we are different. And I think especially in today's world that it's so important to see, you know, how we can form impressions of people that once you get to know them, you realize, oh, I'm a lot like that person.
Exactly. And of course, in your situation, without giving away all the wonderful secrets in your book, it was a breakup, right? That was the precipitant for you
right.
to get help.
Right. And it's funny because, as I say in the book, that a lot of times what we come in with, what we call the presenting problem,
right.
is often a symptom of something else. And, you know, I like to say that I'm listening for the music under the lyrics. The
exactly.
lyrics are, I'm here because of a breakup. The music is what underlying pattern got you into this situation in the first place? What was your role in this? Even if something did happen out there, right?
Right. Right.
What is, we have choices at every turn about how we respond or what we listen to or what we take action on. And when we realize we have so much agency over our lives, it's so empowering.
Yeah, it absolutely so is so. And, you know, I think that so many people are not really willing to do that kind of introspective work.
Right. Well, it's so much easier to say the problems are out there. The problems are circumstantial or situational. And it's a lot harder to do what we do in therapy, which is we hold up the mirror to someone and we say, I want you to look at your reflection. And we do this with great compassion. But I want you to look at your reflection and see yourself in a way that maybe you aren't willing or able to do, you know, or haven't been willing or able to do up to this point.
Exactly. So listen, what did you really learn about yourself?
Well, I think that the process of therapy is this unraveling of all of the things that maybe we feel ashamed of or we feel like will be too painful mm-hmm. to talk about. And what we realize is that once we do talk about them, we get this enormous sense of freedom.
Right.
And I think that we're able to also, you know, act in our own best interest. So many times when we're hiding something, when we're not acknowledging certain feelings, we end up self-sabotaging. We end up getting in our own way. And one of the things that happens is we use our feelings to, like, as a compass. So I'm feeling sad, I'm feeling anxious. Well, what is that telling me? What is it telling me about what's not working so that I can make things work better? Even things like envy. I feel like people are so afraid of feeling envious of other people. But I always say follow your envy. It tells you what you want. So instead of bathing in the envy, you can say, what can I do to take steps to give myself something that I really want instead of just sitting here resenting other people for having it?
Exactly. You know, I think about when I did my postgraduate work at McGill at the Psychiatric Institute, there was a professor, he was actually a psychiatrist, who said to me, he said, look, we're all in this anyways as clinicians to try to figure out our own issues and resolve our own problems. And I think it takes a lot of courage and a lot of chutzpah and a lot of honesty, right, to really be able to acknowledge that and do something about it.
Well, right. You know, in fact, we're turning the book into a television series, and one of the things that I really want to do in the television series, like I do in the book, is to show how human we all are as clinicians. And I think that on the one hand, you know, we use our humanity all the time in the therapy room, not that we're bringing our own problems into the room, but that we're using our lived experience to help other people with their lived experience. And yet people at the same time you know, feel that's kind of icky, you know, that we do have real lives, that we do have multidimensional lives. I had a colleague who, she and her husband were trying to have a baby, and she finally got pregnant, and she was standing in a Starbucks when she got a call from her physician saying that the pregnancy wasn't viable, and she broke into tears on that call, mm-hmm. and a patient happened to walk in and saw her crying and never came back to therapy. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's this, you know, when I expose myself in the book, I feel like it's not creepy, it's just human, right? It's that we all go through life, and I think you probably want a therapist who has gotten through struggles and come out the other end and has had that experience and kind of can be your tour guide on that experience.
I mean, I agree 100%, of course. And I mean, that's one of the reasons when I do the, you know, the TV shows and the Ask Beattie shows, I use, you know, the pronoun we, that we've all had ups and downs, that we've all had relationship issues and problems. And I mean, it's not like we're going to sit and talk about our own family of origin trauma, perhaps. But I think it is important that our patients know that, as you say, that we're human and that we get it and that we are not somehow completely immune and above life's struggles.
Right. I think it really normalizes it. I have so many times when somebody will come in, and I think especially there's a difference between men and women, where men will come in and they'll say, I've never told anyone this before.
Right.
And literally, they have never told a soul. And what they tell me generally isn't something that you would think they would feel so protective of, but it's so hard for men to be vulnerable that even something that feels maybe smaller to a woman, perhaps, you know, for them, they literally couldn't tell anybody that. Women will come in and they'll say, I've never told anyone this before, except for my mother, my sister, and my best friend, right? So maybe they've told 1 to 3 people. And then what they tell me tends to be something that I can see why they were maybe more protective of that. But the point is that even no matter who it is, right, no matter whether it's somebody who's told 1 person or 0 people or 3 people, that we aren't talking about things that would make us feel better and more connected to other people to talk about. Again, I'm not talking about sort of the deep family of origin stuff that maybe you want to talk to a therapist about, but just normal things that you're experiencing in life. We feel like we're so alone in those experiences that we don't share them with other people, and then we're all walking around thinking, I'm the only one. I'm the
exactly.
only one struggling like this.
Do you think that had you not experienced the shocking breakup that you had, that you would have gotten into therapy?
I don't think I would have gotten into therapy with that therapist in the same way at that time.
Uh-huh.
And what was so interesting was the first thing that I said to him was, you know, now I've wasted all these years with this person and half my life is over. And my whole narrative was about the breakup, but he glommed onto that one phrase, half my life is over.
Right.
And he realized that that's what I was really there for, which was this real reckoning at midlife about meaning and what was important and what was I doing and what was preventing me from getting it. And that was what our therapy was about, as you can see in the book. And there were secrets that I was keeping from him.
Yes.
Not necessarily because I was purposely keeping those secrets, although in part I was, but mostly because I was keeping them for myself. I kept telling myself, well, that's not really important. That's not the main issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's so much easier to focus on this big breakup than it is to focus on all these other things that I haven't been paying attention to in my life that really do need attention.
Exactly. So you learned an enormous amount, you know, lessons to be learned in the strangest of ways, right?
That's right. And I think that so many people are seeing themselves in this book because we learn through other people's stories. So on the surface, it might seem like my issue or the issues of the people who come to see me that I write about are different from whoever the reader might be. But so many people are saying, I'm just like that. I do that. Even though my circumstances might be different, I learned so much about the ways that I pretend, that I get in my own way, that I don't show up. These are about my loneliness, you know, whatever it is. And I think that, again, that's what's so important is being able to say, how can I learn something about myself through these experiences?
Exactly. Well, I mean, you've had obviously some really good therapy with Wendell. I mean, so many therapies and so many therapists seem to prescribe to what I call bandage therapy. That's just, as you cited somewhere, you know, the Nike logo of just do it without really digging and without going back and without emotionally working through what happened and what didn't happen, so that you're finally able to really live in the moment without having, you know, what I say, one foot in the past and one foot in the present. I mean, your therapy was really and is really something very substantial that so many people are not lucky enough to really have.
Well, right. I call that problem of the week therapy, where people,
right.
what you call bandage therapy,
right.
where people just come in. I see that especially with couples, where mm-hmm. I don't do that kind of therapy with people, where they come in and they're going to bring in the problem of the week, and then we're going to, you know, help them with the problem of the week. You know, that's not helpful for them. What's helpful for them is to say, let's look at the underlying issue here, because you're just going to replicate that issue in all different kinds of circumstances. So instead of coming in with 50 different problems for a year, let's talk about the one problem that's causing the 50 different problems.
Exactly.
And that's how people really make substantial changes from the time they came in to the time they leave.
Well, we're certainly on the same page when it comes to, you know, how to do good therapy. You know, the other thing that I really loved, Lori, was your honesty about how your own issues were starting to really get in the way of your therapy with other patients.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I was really, I don't know how much they were getting in the way. It was more that I was learning about myself from what they were going through. But I think that all of the stories are kind of interwoven in the sense that, you know, I was dealing with a person who was this young newlywed who was dying of cancer.
Right.
And it really brought up, you know, something that I hadn't been looking at with my own health issues and taking care of those and my own fear of you know, looking at my mortality, which
right.
I think we all have. And what I really learned from working with that person who I call her Julie in the book is that it's so important that we are aware of our limited time on this earth.
Exactly.
Because it helps us to live more intentionally every single day.
No, it certainly does. And, you know, something that, you know, my daughter reminds me, she says, oh, Mom, you know, you've been talking about the passing of time for such a long, long time, but I've been aware for so long. And, you know, as you're saying, how precious every day is, and that we don't have time to waste. And that we need to dig in and acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we possibly can the issues, so that we're really going to then be able to live life to the fullest and not waste time.
Right. And we have to do that at any age. So, you know, in the book, there's somebody that I see who's in her 20s and she keeps hooking up with the wrong guys and can't understand, you know, why this keeps happening to her. And at one point she even hooks up with a guy from the waiting room and she thinks that's a step up because she says, well, at least he's in therapy, which of course it was,
right.
you know, bad news. And she's in her 20s and she really has this whole vista of time ahead of her. But if she doesn't figure out why she keeps getting into these situations,
exactly.
she's going to waste all those years ahead of her. And there's another person in the book who's about to turn 70, and she says to me, she's had, you know, some failed marriages, her adult children are estranged from her, she wants their forgiveness, they don't want to give it to her, and she says, you know, if things don't get better, I don't see a reason to live. And yet there's so much that she can do to change her life, and her life changes substantially. So I feel like at any age, whether you're in your 20s or about to turn 70, we still have the ability to use our time wisely.
If we choose to.
If we choose to, but we have to make that choice.
Exactly. You know, what? As I was going through your book this morning, I came upon a passage by Dr. James Prochaska and his model of behavioral change, which I thought was so interesting, where, you know, where change is occurring, there's a pre-contemplation stage. Do you remember that?
Yes, there's so much that goes into
right.
making a change, that when somebody actually makes a change, a lot has happened that they aren't even aware of.
Right.
Where, you know, where they weren't even thinking about changing, and then they were, you know, maybe contemplating change, but they weren't ready to take action. And then there's the preparation stage where they're preparing to make the change. And then they finally make the change and they think, oh, I just changed. No, you didn't.
Right.
a lot happened before that.
Right. And then, of course, the maintenance of the action, as you said, the pre-contemplation.
That's the hardest part.
Yes, it is, whether or not we're talking about exercising or diet or anything. And, you know, what I was finding, and, you know, I was looking at my year-end situation with my own patients. And in my practice, it'd be interesting to hear about yours. I mean, everything is falling apart when people give me a call. Nobody ever calls and says, Beattie, I need to improve in my communication and problem solving. I mean, that never happens. And yet the action, the ongoing action and maintenance is such a challenge for the majority of people to really keep it going. You know, I want and I hope and I need, and yet the follow through is really the challenge. And I'm sure you find the same thing, right?
Yeah, I do. And I think partly it's because those old ways are so ingrained.
Right.
And ingrained, you know, for years and sometimes decades. And so people think, well, I should just be able to change really quickly. And it takes a lot of practice with the change.
Exactly.
But, you know, I think that people are so hard on themselves because if they slip up, if they go back, like say someone says, oh, this is why I keep having those arguments with my partner, right? And then they're like, they're doing really well and they're reacting differently and things are going better in their relationship and they're getting along really well. And then one day the person has a big blow up. And they say, oh, see, it's not working. Right? It's like when you're on a diet and you're like, oh, no, I went off my diet. Well, screw it. Just, you know, I'm not going to diet anymore. It's like all of a sudden you feel like all is lost. But all is not lost. It's simply that, you know, you have to expect that you can't expect perfection of yourself. You have to expect that change takes time and that the more you practice it and if you feel like you've kind of fallen back or regressed, then you just pick yourself up and you move on. And I think we have to have more compassion for ourselves. You can't change without having self-compassion.
Exactly. And of course, the importance of having the coach. I mean, and I'm not talking about a life coach here. I mean, when you look at professional athletes, I mean, people are really invested in getting all of this help for strength training. And I mean, I'm a competitive tennis player. And I mean, I never could have done it without my father, who was my coach, who was there, and everything that went into, you know, being a competitive athlete. And yet here, I think that there's still quite a bit of reluctance in reaching out and asking for help. And are you finding that also where you are in California, in L.A.?
I do. I feel like people believe that asking for help is a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
Or that there's something deficient about them. And there's this perception that everybody else seems to do it just fine on their own. And we also have this culture of independence, that we should be doing things, that we value independence. We value doing things on our own. But we really grow in connection with others.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And you know, you're talking about your television show, and I read somewhere last week that you're also going to be beginning a new podcast in 2020. Tell us a little bit about that.
I'm launching a new podcast with iHeartMedia, and Katie Couric is producing it, and my co-host is Guy Winch, who is a fellow TED Talker like me. And he's also a fellow therapist like me, and we each write advice columns. I write the Dear Therapist column for The Atlantic. He writes the advice column for TED. And we are going to do a twist on advice, which is people will bring their dilemmas to us, and we will discuss it with them, and we will also discuss it as therapists, so they get that perspective, which is different from don't talk to your mother-in-law, you know, that kind of advice.
Right.
But it's very much a perspective on sort of, you know, what I do in my Dear Therapist column and what I do in the book, which is I really pull back the curtain and say, here's what a therapist would be thinking and how they would be conceptualizing what's going on with you. And what they might not say to you in a first session, we're going to bring that out to help you here. And then the person goes and tries the advice, and then they come back and they tell us how it worked out, and we we look at, you know, what worked and what didn't and adjust if necessary. And I think what's interesting about this is we never hear in these other situations, you know, what happened? What happened after
right.
they got the advice?
Right.
And so I think it's really instructive to hear, well, what worked and why was it hard or why was it not hard? And what were the unexpected benefits, if any, which I think people often find when they try something new.
Could you ever have imagined what would have happened with your career, really, since having written the book? My goodness, a television series, a podcast. I mean, it's really amazing what you've done. I mean, I hope you're really proud of yourself, Lori.
Well, I'm really gratified that so many people are reading the book because I think it opens up these conversations about emotional health that people were afraid to have. And I think it reduces stigma around just normal struggles that we're all going through. And it's funny because I thought when I was writing the book that maybe three people would read it, you know, and now, you know, it's 9 months later, it's still on the New York Times bestseller list. Right. So it's you know, it's being read by a lot of people. And I think that speaks to our hunger for these deeper connections, our hunger for seeing people like us, our hunger for talking about things that maybe we thought we shouldn't be talking about. And so if in some small way it's helping to change the culture around emotional health, then for that I'm very grateful.
And listen, I am very, very grateful that you found the time today. I mean, you must be incredibly busy. Hopefully you're taking a little bit of time off during the holidays to, you know, to talk with me. Because, as I say, my daughter emailed me and said, Mom, you really got to read the book. I ordered the book. I loved the book. And you and I actually talked a couple
we
of
did.
Years ago. We
yes.
did. And look at what's happened, Lori, in the last few years.
I'm always happy to talk with you, and thanks to your daughter for bringing the book to your attention. Tell her I really appreciate it.
Well, Jordana, if you're listening, and I think she is, thank you, sweetie, because I did love the book. And Lori, again, thank you so much, and let's keep in touch, and happy holidays and happy new year.
Oh, my pleasure. Happy holidays.
And congratulations on all your successes.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye. Well, Lori Gottlieb and the book, and everybody listening should really buy this book, and I did. I love it. It's Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. And in so many, so many ways, it helps us all to free ourselves up. And now we are going to be listening to my favorite song, Marlo Thomas, Free to Be You and Me. So sing along. How I love this song. You know, for those of you who've been listening to the Ask Beattie Show for the last number of years, you probably heard me say that I was one of two people that ran the entire school social services program in Greater Montreal, and we were trying to teach the kids communication skills and how to express their emotions, their anger, their sadness, their happiness, their joy. And I used to bring in Marlo Thomas's record, and I just love the song, Free to Be You and Me. And Jim and I, we actually had an opportunity in East Hampton a couple of years ago to meet Marlo Thomas and her husband, Phil Donahue. It was very, very, very exciting, especially since I had been a fan of hers for so many years. And talking about Free to Be You and Me in the New York Times, so we're going to get into the New York Times Charles Blow column this morning. And he was talking about all of the different things that have actually changed in the last decade. And of course, he's gay, and he's been out and proud of it and writes about it. And what he says is this, you know, talking about being free, but perhaps no subjects inspired a more dramatic change in the way Americans considered basic human behaviors as the huge swings on the acceptance of LGBT people and our country's relationship to drugs. So he says in 2010, for the first time, Americans' acceptance of gay relationships crossed the 50% mark. Well, that is long overdue. Now that number is well into the 70s. So people are learning and they are working through their stereotypes and they're working through their scare and their pain. over things that they don't quite maybe understand. And over the same period, acceptance of same-sex marriage, it went from the 40s to the 60s. Acceptance of gay adoption went from below 50% to above 70%. So being gay now, and I say it is about time, became mainstream. And this reached further than just gays and lesbians. And there's a new visibility for trans people, drag, and fluidity. And YouGov poll asked Americans to place themselves on the Kinsey scale, where 0 is completely heterosexual and 6 is completely homosexual. And while only 5% rated themselves as completely gay, 20% rated themselves somewhere between completely gay and completely straight. And this is what we mean by the fluidity. That is not to say, according to Charles Blow, that homophobia disappeared or that there isn't a tremendous amount of work that still needs to be done around the issues of bullying, discrimination, safety, and sexual health. But it is to say that the American society, and it is a really good thing, has taken a quantum leap forward in just a few years on these issues. So we still have, you know, we have a long way to go, but things are definitely, definitely moving along. You know, a friend and a colleague of mine sent me an email, and I'm really hoping that we're going to have enough time to go through this. Diana Kirshner, who is a New York Times bestselling author, Love in 90 Days, she sent me an article that she wrote that appeared in Psychology Today, and it's 9 online dating security tips to avoid being scammed. So I'm going to try and go through this article as quickly as I possibly can, because what she's found is in the latest FBI figures, singles lost more than $362 million in romance scams. So according to the FBI, so we have the $362 million in romance scams, the blog lays out the latest online dating security tips. We really do have to be careful. We have to do good assessments and the red flags that we all need to look out for, because scammers, they're very, very clever professionals who know exactly how to get women to fall in love with them. And I don't know whether it's just heterosexuals, but in this particular article, men trying to get women to fall in love with them without ever meeting in person. And of course, that is a danger, since 80% of people these days, according to studies, are meeting online, are meeting on the dating sites. So we have to be really careful and mindful and not let our loneliness and our neediness, give in to real possibilities of being scammed. So this occurs even to sophisticated, intelligent, and educated women who are lonely and needy. And of course, we're all wanting to find love. So because organized romance scam rings actually use strategic protocols, who would have thought? So there are strategies out there that people use in order to scam women. She says, Diana says, I have seen this firsthand when two women in different cities who had just started her love mentoring program were asked to send money to their matches, and the requests were worded the same and came in on the same day. And Dr. Diana Kirshner says that one of the women was seriously considering sending the scammer money, and I'm not sure why she would do that, until she talked with Dr. Kirshner. And today's scammers, they truly know what they are doing. But the good news is that you can easily avoid these criminals. And yes, they are criminals. by using these 9 key online dating security tips. And this is what she says. And we are going to finish this. We're going to be able to finish the article next week because I think it's really important since just about everybody is online looking for love. So scammers often claim that they are doctors working abroad. They're in the military in an overseas location, working in the oil services industry in the Middle East or Africa, management consultants working internationally, or gemologists on assignment to mining operations overseas. So they sound like really high-powered guys. And online security tip 2 is that they live or work, or they say they live or work outside of the country. So for North Americans, it is important to know that romance scams are the specialties of international scam artists. That's interesting. And look at the list of false occupations that they favor. The doctors, the military, working in the oil industry in the Middle East or Africa, gemologists. So for overseas readers, we need to really be aware of foreign nationals who work in the above occupations. And of course, my thesis is whether or not we are trying to find love internationally, or whether we are trying to find love in our synagogue, our church, or online on all of the different dating sites, we need to be careful. We need to do really good assessments. We really need to read my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, that teaches people exactly how to assess who is right for you and who is wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. You know, I wrote the book for my daughter, Jordana. I wanted her to have an easy time, you know, when she was beginning to date. And the assessment process, it's not sexy. It is not fun. But what it does do, it educates. It empowers, and above all, that it really keeps you safe. And one of the interesting things from the research that I did with 450 people in the Providence, Connecticut, Boston area was that the assessment process actually takes close to a year, not a week, not 90 days, to really find out who somebody is and somebody is not. And we have to go through the process. And it's like having me in your wallet or in your purse, guiding you and looking at things, maybe looking at some blind spots that you might have. Because like all of us, we all want to be in love. We want more than anything in the world to have somebody love us. But we need to be careful. And somebody recently asked me, you know, do I prescribe background checks? Years and years ago, I would have said, you know, no. And yet today, yes, yes, I do. I think that needs to be, you know, part of the assessment process. And no, you should not be sending money to anybody whose credit card has been denied. And that's the whole thing with these scams. You know, people within a very short period of time after they kind of con you into thinking that there's going to be something really significant that the two of you are going to share, ultimately ask for money. So don't do it. And next week, I'm going to go through Diana Kirshner's article in a lot more depth. Well, everybody, this is the last show, the last Ask Beattie show for 2019. I have loved speaking with you. I have loved your text, your comments, your questions, your emails. And I leave you with my 2 weekly messages, and I hope that you're all going to take that in. And of course, the first is to do whatever it is you need to do, whether or not it's having therapy or coaching. to find ways to really love yourself and definitely do what is in your best interest and be aware of what is in your best interest. And of course, too, with the world being what it is today, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to love each other and accept each other.